Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Chuck story when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper, things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and that clad coin or currency. And you know, that is true when you're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for all of us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and our politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933 when they did it, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin in order to take away the people's right to property and then destroy those property rights. Now, if we intend to regain our rights, our duties, and our capacities, then we're going to have to first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. This is in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home school. Now, for more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It doesn't cost you anything. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative. It's entertaining. It's educational. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, talking about checks, I brought up to you, I said, you know, a guy named A.J. Porth asked me this question, kind of a strange question, you think about it. He said, do you want me to explain to you about checks? Now, I'm 40 years old or more. I didn't think I needed anybody to explain checks to me, but I did, as it turned out. Now, A.J. Porth is long dead and buried, and A.J. Porth told me the story about checks, and when he got through, I've never been the same since. I couldn't count until I was 37. Once I learned how to count, you know, then things start turning around for me. And I always tell my students, I say, as soon as you learn how to count and you understand how checks work, things will turn around for you too. So when we were finished last time, we were talking about this thing of famous quotations on money, famous quotations, people like Thomas Jefferson and Aristotle, the Bible, John Moody, James A. Garfield, President Andrew Jackson, what some of these people had to say about money. Now, Woodrow Wilson had this to say. He said, a great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated, and the growth of the nation, therefore, and all of our activities are in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled, and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, and no longer a government by conviction, no longer a government by vote of the majority, but rather a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men. Now, that was President Woodrow Wilson said that back in World War I. What was he talking about? Pope Pius XI said this in the first place, then it is patent that in our days not alone is wealth accumulated, but immense power and despotic economic domination are concentrated in the hands of a few, and that those few are frequently not the owners, but the trustees and directors of invested funds who administer them at their own good pleasure. This power becomes particularly irresistible when exercised by those who, because they hold and control that money, are able to govern credit and determine its allotment. And for that reason, supplying, so to speak, the lifeblood to the entire economic body and grasping, as it were, in their hands the very soul of production so that no one dare breathe against their will. That was Pope Pius XI. Who are these few men that control this kind of immense power over our economy? Where'd that come from?
Now, here's what the Rothschilds had to, say. The Rothschild brothers back in 1863 said this. It said, "Dear Sir, it's a letter written to a fellow named Morton and Vandergould, number 3 Wall Street, New York, New York, by the Rothschild brothers. And they said, "Dear Sirs, a Mr. John Sherman has written us from a town in Ohio as to the profits that may be made in the national banking business under a recent act of your Congress, a copy of which act accompanied his letter. Apparently this act has been drawn upon the plan formulated here last summer by the British Bankers Association and by the association recommended to our American friends as one that, if enacted into law, would prove highly profitable to the banking fraternity throughout the world. Mr. Sherman declares that there has never before been such an opportunity for capitalists to accumulate money as that presented by this act, and that the old plan, the state banks, is so unpopular that the new scheme will, by contrast, be most favorably regarded, notwithstanding the fact that it gives the national banks an almost absolute control of the national finance. The few who can understand the system," he says, "will either be so interested in its profits or so dependent upon its favors that there will be no opposition from that class, while on the other hand, the great body of people, mentally incapable of comprehending the tremendous advantages that capital derives from the system, will bear its burdens without complaint and perhaps even without suspecting that the system is inimical to their best interests. Please advise us fully as to this matter and also state whether or not you will be of assistance to us. If we conclude to establish a national bank in the city of New York, while awaiting your reply, we are respectfully yours, your servants, the Rothschild brothers." Now, these bankers, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Kuhnlobes and so on around the world, have immense power. And checking and checks are a part and parcel of that power. And every time you write a check, you underwrite and ratify that power. And evidently, the people of America, indeed the people of the Western world, believe in and are in no opposition to the fundamental power of banking being held in the hands of a few men. It would seem like to me that either, one, they like the system, or two, they're mentally incapable of comprehending the tremendous advantages that capital derives from the system. Now, these very same people that may be mentally handicapped and unable, mentally and incapable of comprehending these advantages that the bankers have through this banking system are also the voters, remember. They're the people that put these politicians into office that create these banking acts. The National Banking Act of 1863 was not enacted by bankers. It was enacted by politicians in the Congress. Now, did these politicians in the Congress understand what they were doing when they handed over this immense power to the Rothschild brothers and to the Rockefellers and Kuhnlobe and the rest of these few men at the top who control our central bank? Now, the average Joe Sixpack goes out and votes, but he doesn't have any comprehension as to how the system works or that the debt that has been accumulated, he's an underwriter for. He doesn't grasp it. Now, for those of us that can, the question arises, well, do we want to? Now, I've pointed out before, we used to have a system under the Ten Commandments of bottom-up control with hard money, gold and silver coin. We've now accepted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto with a top-down system. And this top-down system is formulated by the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a heavy progressive income tax in the central bank. Now, obviously, we wanted the income tax in the central bank. We've got it. We voted it in. And we've kept it there, and we keep voting for the people that keep telling us that it's good for us. And we keep paying for it without complaint. If that's what you want to do, stick with the program. You've succeeded. Now, if you, like I, or like me, have come to the conclusion that this isn't good for me, this isn't good for George Gordon, and you want out, we'll keep listening up. If our nation can issue a dollar loan, this is Thomas Edison now. Thomas Edison only went to the third grade. Henry Ford only went to the sixth. These were two of the biggest industrialists in our nation. Now, I told you yesterday what Henry Ford had to say. Now, here's Thomas Edison. He said, if our nation can issue a dollar loan, it is capable of issuing a dollar bill. The factor which makes the loan valid is the same which would make a dollar good. Both are promises to pay, but one enriches the usurers and the other would help the people. Usurers. Now, remember I showed you yesterday that usury is prohibited in Scripture. We all have mortgages on our houses, and we all pay interest on our car loans. We believe in usury in this country. We practice it. We love it. But is it good for us? Would we be better off if we opted out? Democratic Congressman Jerry Voorhees said this. He said the banks, commercial banks, and the Federal Reserve create all of the money of this nation, and its people pay interest on every dollar of that newly created money, which means that private banks exercise unconstitutionally, immorally, and ridiculously the power to tax the people. That income tax, by the way, is a tax that's put on the paper money that we use in violation of Leviticus 19, 35, and 36. Income tax is a penalty. It's a penalty for broken law. It violates the law that says thou shalt not steal. And as long as you want to practice theft, you can pay the income tax. For every newly created dollar dilutes to some extent the value of every other dollar that's already in circulation. Money creation is the greatest economic power known to man. The power ought always to be exercised in the interest of all of the people, never for the sake of private gain of a privileged few. Now, this guy, Ben Bernanke, is creating money at the rate of 18% a year. And it dilutes the value of every dollar that you've got in your pocket. And then every dollar that's put into circulation bears interest, and you have to pay it. And that's why you pay an income tax, and that's why you're a surety underwriter on the national debt. That's what checks and checking are all about. Now, if that's what you want, hey, boys and girls, you've arrived. Alfred Lawson had this to say: when the international financiers withdrew the most, withdrew most of the money from circulation back in 1929, and brought on this diabolical depression, the newspaper owners were caught short and could not meet their financial obligations. So the financiers began to choke them, and they are now choking them. And what is more, they intend to choke them to death before they get through with them. And in fact, the financiers intend to take over all the newspapers in the United States within the next few years. Boys and girls, all the newspapers and the media have already been taken over by the bankers and the financiers. And that's why Katie Couric and Brian Williams never report to you the value of gold and silver in the marketplace. There are reports that are approved, and there are reports that are not approved, and the mainstream media only tells you what you're supposed to know. And that's what the protocols of the learned elders tell us. Now, Alfred Lawson on usury had this to say. He said, interest is the thief of everybody. Interest, usury, is the thief of everybody. It robs the government, it robs the manufacturer, it robs the merchants, and it robs the workmen. It robs everybody except a few financiers who control the money and money supply, and by its control they gain the power to stifle governments, stifle industry, and to stifle trade and employment. Robert Hemphill, for 8 years the credit manager of the Federal Reserve in Atlanta, Georgia, said, if all bank loans were paid, no one would have a bank deposit and there would not be a dollar of currency in circulation. Now, this is a staggering thought. We are completely dependent on the commercial banks, and someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation. Now, if the banks create ample synthetic money, we're prosperous, and if not, we starve. We're absolutely without a permanent monetary system. When one gets a complete grasp upon the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position is almost incredible. But there it is. Yet the banking problem is the most important subject that intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon. It is so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it is widely understood and the defects remedied very soon. Now remember, that was Robert Hemphill, 8 years credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Georgia. He said, now listen to this again. He said, now, if the banking problem, which we're all embroiled in right now, the banking meltdown worldwide, if this banking problem, it is the most important subject that intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon. It is so important, he said, that our present civilization may collapse unless it's widely understood and its defects remedied very soon. I couldn't agree more, and I think that our civilization is on the verge of collapse. And I think that what we're witnessing here is the fulfillment of Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. Charles A. Lindbergh, Sr. Now, this isn't the boy that flew across the Atlantic, but his daddy. Charles A. Lindbergh, Sr., writing on the panic of 1920, said this. He said, under the Federal Reserve Act, panics are scientifically created. The present panic is the first scientifically created one, worked out as we figure a mathematical problem. And Salmon P. Chase, he was at one time the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. While he was the Secretary of the Treasury, he said, in referring to the National Bank Act of 1862, he said, my agency in promoting the passage of the National Banking Act was the greatest financial mistake of my life. It has built up a monopoly which affects every interest in this country, and it should be repealed. But before that can be accomplished, the people will be arrayed on one side and the banks on the other in a contest such as we have never seen before in this country. Boys and girls, I think Mr. Chase made a mistake. I do not believe that there's ever going to be a conflict between the banking interests and the people of America. And that's because I don't think the people of America can grasp or understand what the problem is. And until you can grasp and understand, see what the problem is, there's no way to grapple with or to solve that problem. The average Joe Sixpack American can't see any difference between a $5 gold piece and a $5 bill. He hasn't got it in his mind. He just doesn't have any way to connect those dots. And until those dots are connected, now if Joe Sixpack could connect the dots, oh, there would be a god-awful confrontation, you can rest assured. But as long as the media and the public education system can control education, control what you know, what you believe, there isn't any fear on the part of the bankers that you're ever going to do anything to improve your circumstance. And you can never improve your circumstance because you don't know what the hell to promise, which is why I thought we'd talk about checks. Now, Senator Carter Glass on June 7th, 1983 said this. He said, I never thought the Federal Reserve System would prove such a failure. The country is in a state of irretrievable bankruptcy. Now, this is in 1983. He said the nation's in a state of irretrievable bankruptcy. Now, just because you're in bankruptcy, just because you're broke, doesn't mean you can't continue to function. Most of you people listening to me right now are bankrupt. You're broke. But you're still functioning. You're hoping against hope that a miracle is going to happen. You can rest assured that that miracle is not going to appear. The miracle isn't going to happen. But you're still making your payments, and you're borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. Well, that's what the American government's doing, and we've been doing that now for the last 40 years. You can move your finances around. You can borrow here and pay there. You can roll your notes over. But the real test of prosperity is, at the end of every year, do you have more net profit than you have liabilities? Do you have more assets at the end of a given period of time than you had at the beginning of that period of time? If you are, you're profitable, and if you don't, you're not. That's simple enough to figure out. And I've had many students come here to class who have been bankrupt for years, and they keep operating their businesses even though the business is unprofitable, and they, in fact, are bankrupt. There was a fella came in here one time, I'll tell you the story here. He was a wheat farmer up in North Dakota farming 15 sections. Now a section is 640 acres. And he was losing about $100,000 a year on his farming operation, and he was raking in or taking in about $3.5 million a year. And on his sales of $3.5 million a year, he was losing $100,000 a year. Now, at one time, his business was profitable, but something happened. And so he asked me, well, what would you do? And I said, well, if it was me, I would close that business down. I would retire. And that's because your business is unprofitable. Now, you've got some equity. I forgot what his equity was, $2, $3, $4 million. But I said, if you continue doing what you're doing, consuming your equity at $100,000 a year, well, then every 10 years, you're throwing $1 million away. And you can keep borrowing money and going on. Well, he went back home. He didn't follow instructions, but he went back home. He continued farming. And about 3 years later, the bank said, we won't roll your note over. Forced him into Chapter 7, and he went upside down. And, of course, they just liquidated his assets, and that was the end of it. Now, the United States is in the same position, and the debt structure is such that we owe more money than we can ever reasonably pay back. Now, that being the case, if you owe more money than you can reasonably pay back, or that you could ever pay back, well, then we call that bankruptcy. And so what you have to do is start over again. You have to liquidate and start over. That means we have to start over where we were in 1787 with 13 colonies, broke, you know, without any assets, but, you know, we're starting out. That's what happened in Argentina, you know, in 2001. Now, when nations go bankrupt, there is a vast turnover of the assets and the wealth of the nation. The United States of America is a corporation, just like China is a corporation, and it does business in the international world, you know, nation to nation. We owe the Saudi Arabians a lot of money, and those people hold collateral. They hold collateral. And right now, you don't have national parks. You have national UN biospheres, and that's collateral that's been transferred to two creditors. That's all you're dealing with there, is collateral transferred to creditors. And the people of America are the underwriters of the debt. Boys and girls, you're going to be sold for that debt, and I showed you that in the last program. You're going to be sold for the debt as bond servants and shipped off to Egypt. Now, your God told you that, and if you just watched international law and common sense, it'd also tell you the same thing. You have never seen that. You've never witnessed that. Nobody's reported that to you on the news, and you didn't learn that in college or high school. But just because you didn't know that doesn't mean that it isn't true, and doesn't mean that isn't the way it's going to work out. And as a reporter, I'm here to report on law. This is the way the law works. Maybe you didn't know that, but then if you didn't know that, ignorance isn't any excuse. I've mentioned that to you a time or two before. Oftentimes I get letters and people write to me and say, I don't believe what you're telling me is true. Well, I don't care. I'm not here to persuade you that I'm telling you the truth. I'm making you a report. Whether you believe it or not, it's irrelevant to me. I don't get paid for convincing you that I'm telling you anything. I get paid. You can rest assured I'm getting paid. I get paid in gold coin. I don't get paid in worthless Federal Reserve notes. And my boss, you know, takes pretty good care of me, and he's got a message, he's got an agenda, and he wants me to tell you what that agenda is, and wants me to pass that word on to you. But, I've said this to people before, you know, they want to know, they'll write a letter, and they'll say, well, who underwrites and who finances you? And I won't tell you. But it isn't you. And you notice that I don't come on the air and ask you for any money. And I've told you people out there, don't even send it. I don't need it, number one. And number two, if you sent me money, and I became dependent upon you for that money, for that financial support, then I would be beholden to you to tell the story that you want me to tell. And that's where the news media is today. Katie Couric receives her paycheck from her master, and she tells the story that her master instructs her to tell. Most people will believe Katie and Brian because they've got better facilities and a bigger audience. They've got the AP and the UP and Reuters and everybody else. And I'm here to tell you that they're a couple of paid professional liars. And they're here lying to you about checks. They're here lying to you about your economy. So the story that I'm telling you here about Alfred Lawson on usury, you know, interest is the thief of everybody. That's a story that came from the Bible. That's a story that came from your God in a law that says you shall not practice usury and interest. Now, we Americans and Canadians and Australians have decided that God didn't know what he was talking about, and so we went up and bought our new cars and our houses, and we've got mortgages and mortgage debt, and we're surety underwriters for the debt of the United States of America and Canada and Australia and everybody else. We got a balance of payments deficit. We don't understand money and the monetary system. We got letters after our name. We go to college. We're smart people. But we have a fundamental misunderstanding concerning this thing of checks and how they work. And because of that, it's going to come back and bite us in the butt. So I just wanted to tell you ahead of time that you and I are the probable cause, proximate cause, they say in law, of our own injury. So don't blame God now when this thing turns turtle on us. Don't get mad at the Rothschilds and everybody else. You know, the Rothschilds came to you and said, give us this power. And you said, that sounds like a good deal to us. Your God said, you shall have no other gods before me. And we said, no, the Rothschilds and George Bush and the United States of America seem like better gods to us. And let's see who we're going to vote for. I haven't seen anybody vote for Jesus Christ. Have you? I haven't even seen him on the ballot. I haven't even seen anybody put his name in nomination. Not that he needs your vote. In fact, he's not a Democrat, and he's not going to come down here and seek your support either. When he comes back, he's going to come back and kick you in the ass, break your legs. He says, every knee is going to bow to me. He said, every knee shall bow to me. And that's going to be a real problem for Americans. Englishmen over there are going to have a little better time of it than we're going to have over here. Americans don't bow their knee to anybody, come hell or high water. My God, we're not bowing our knee to anybody. When the boss comes back, the only solution to that is break our legs. Now, you know, so I just thought I'd pass that on to you. Now, America's bankrupt. We're upside down. Can't pay our bills. And then people like Lawson, Robert Hemphill, Charles A. Lindbergh, Salmon P. Chase, Carter Glass, They tell us a story. Now, there's a guy named Conrad LeBeau, on fractional reserve banking. Listen to this little story here on fractional reserve banking. He said, if you or I write a check without having the full value in cash to back it up, we have written a bad check. If a bank writes a check without the full value in cash to back it up, the bank has written a bad check. The bank, however, is in a unique position to circulate its bad checks as money, merely by stamping them paid and then crediting the depositor's checking or savings account with some book entries. The banks are getting away with this fraudulent activity because most of us do not cash our checks, and we use checks and credit cards as a substitute for cash, as money. And as a result, many banks are making loans up to 33 times the amount of the actual money or cash they have to loan. This technique is known as fractional reserve banking, or check kiting, if you and I were doing it. Today, the American people have unwittingly become a party to the check kiting scheme of the bankers by accepting checks and depositing them, and then writing checks against those book entry deposits to help the banks pass on their bad checks as money. Every time you write a check, you endorse and underwrite this fraudulent system. So if that's what you want, keep after it. Now, I took a look at this some years back, and I said, you know, it's time for me to make a change. So I closed my bank accounts. Now I collect in gold coin. I collect the cash. And I'm not a participant in the fraudulent check kiting schemes. I don't use credit cards, and I don't use checks. Am I recommending that you close your bank account and stop using checks and credit cards? Not at all. Not at all. I'm not a moralist. I'm not here to tell you how to live your life. I'm here to make a report. My report is, here's what you're doing, here's what you have done, here's the results that we see so far, here's the results that we can expect in the future. If that's what you want, keep voting for it. If that isn't what you want, then you need to figure out some way to make an intelligent change, then don't you vote? That's how simple that is. Mayor John F. Hyen of New York said, the real menace of our public, or our republic rather, is the invisible government, which like a giant octopus sprawls its slimy length over our city, state, and nation. At the head is a small group of banking houses, generally referred to as international bankers. And this little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run our government for their own selfish ends. George Bush gets his orders from David Rockefeller. That's the bottom line. And so does Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid. And when you elect Barack Obama, he will take his instructions from David Rockefeller also. And if he gets uppity, like Ronald Reagan does, he'll get shot. That's the end of that argument. Now, for you and I, you know, the bottom feeders here, you know, if we want to make some meaningful changes, you know, you and I can do that. And you and I can stop underwriting the fraudulent, top-down, check-kiting scheme. And we can go back to practicing the Ten Commandments with the bottom-up, hard-money gold and silver coin. Now, that's what our law school is all about. This law school is in the business of teaching people how to practice the Ten Commandments in the bottom-up system of government, which does not require that the majority of the people out there join with us. I don't give a damn if 300 million Americans all practice checks and check kiting, and I'm the last man in America using gold and silver. It's irrelevant to me. I can practice the Ten Commandments and just weights and balances, and I can prosper from it and prosper at your expense. And I'm going to do just that. Have been in the past. I'm doing that right now, and I'm going to continue to do it. And I think that you ought to give that a thought. Not here to tell you what to do, just here, I'm saying, why don't you give that some consideration? Because in the years between 1787 and about 1950, we Americans became the wealthiest, most prosperous nation in the world, practicing thou shalt not steal with just weights and balances from the bottom-up government, practicing the Ten Commandments. We did a hell of a lot better than we did after we started adopting the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, you know, with a central bank and an income tax. Now, if you want to pay the income tax, have at it. I looked at it and said, I don't think that's a very good program, so I opted out. Now, many people, I'm not the only man in America that's done this. There are thousands in America that have done the same thing, who have taken a look as intelligent men. This is what Robert Hemphill said. This isn't George Gordon saying that I'm intelligent now. And this is Robert Hemphill said, that the single most important subject that intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon is the banking problem. And so I'm not that intelligent, but I reflected on it and I said, oh my God, I didn't know these guys were doing that to me. Once I learned how to count and I found out what David Rockefeller and the Rothschilds and these central bankers are doing, I said, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to participate in it. Here's a couple more here. Sir Josiah Stamp, president of the Bank of England, said this. He said in an informal talk to 150 University of Texas students in 1920. This is a Bank of England international banker. And in 1920, he was at the University of Texas, probably in Austin. His name is Josiah Stamp. Listen to what he said. He said, banking was conceived in iniquity, and it was born in sin. Bankers own the world. Take it away from them. but leave them the power to create money. And with the flick of a pen, they will create enough money to buy it all back again. Take this great power away from bankers, and all great fortunes like mine will disappear. And they ought to disappear, because this would then be a better and a happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be the slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let those bankers continue to create your money. Now, you talk about an insider giving you the straight skinny. I can't think of a more insider or a greater insider statement than this Josiah Stamp, a more profound statement. I'm going to read it to you one more time. Listen to this. In case you're driving down the road and you weren't paying attention, oh, what did he say? Let me tell you once more. This guy's name is Sir Josiah Stamp. He was at that time in 1920 the president of the Bank of England. This is the world's number one insider banker in 1920. Today, this number one insider banker in the world would be Ben Bernanke. Imagine Ben Bernanke making this statement. He hasn't, and he probably won't, but Sir Josiah Stamp said in 1920, when talking to just 150 University of Texas students, he said, banking was conceived in iniquity, and it was born in sin, and bankers own the world. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with the flick of a pen, they will create enough money to buy it all back again. Take this great power away from bankers, and all great fortunes like mine will disappear. And they ought to disappear, because this would then be a better and a happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be the slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let them continue to create your money. Vote for. That's what you need to do. Vote for. You had one guy here that said in this round of election here in the United States, one man, his name was Ron Paul. He said, let's abolish the Federal Reserve and let's abolish the income tax. He said, in concert with Sir Josiah Stamp, let's take the money-making power out of the hands of these private bankers. And the people of America ignored Ron Paul like he was suffering from bubonic plague. Now, I'm not at all sure that Ron Paul, had you all got behind him and elected him as president, would have survived long enough to have made any intelligent changes like John F. Kennedy. Remember, Kennedy was the guy that said, I think what we want to do is print our own money out of the Treasury. All I did was get him killed. Hey, I'm running a little overtime here, kids. I got to give you a reminder that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in more than 112 countries daily, worldwide, over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through our website as well at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's 417-273-4967. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the opinions, the beliefs of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I gave you the sources of information here on famous quotations. Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, Rothschild Brothers, Pope Pius XI, Woodrow Wilson. Now, these people are very famous, very prosperous, very powerful people. And, you know, they give us a story. They tell us something of the story about money and checks. Now, let me go back here. So I'm going to tell you the check story over here. A.J. Porth, where we started our conversation, told me a story about a guy named Joe the Barber. And he said Joe the Barber was a little barber up in Des Moines, Iowa. And this is back about 1932, right in the middle of the Depression, as the Depression is taking hold of the nation like it is today. And we still had our gold and silver coin. Now, Joe was doing business in cash, but Sam the banker came in and said to Joe, he said, I've been hired on with a new job up in Chicago, and I need a shave, a shampoo, a haircut, and a manicure. And Joe the barber said, well, I'm sorry, Sam, I can't take you in because I'm busy right now, but if you want to sit there and wait, and I'll take you when your turn comes. And Sam the banker said, listen, I got to catch a train at 1 o'clock. I will pay you $9. Now, he looked at these services, you know, shave and a haircut, you know, is 4 bits. And Joe the barber, now, you know, a working man, is being offered by Sam the banker, the guy that can flick a pen, write a check, $9. Now here's Joe the barber. He makes about $9 a day. $9 a day. And all of a sudden, here's the banker says, I'll pay you $9 for just doing my services if you'll do them right now. So he's appealing to Joe's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, primarily greed and lust. And Joe the barber says, well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. If I do Sam the banker right now, I'll get $9. I'll get his check for $9. And then I can continue doing business this afternoon, and I'll make another $4.50. Instead of making $9 today, I'll make $13.50. So he says, yeah, you're on. Get in the chair. I'll take care of you. Puts the rest of the customers to the back of the line, takes old Sam, the banker, in and gives him his shave, his shampoo, his haircut, and his manicure. Sam leaves, gets on the train, goes to Chicago. Now, here's Joe. He's sitting here with the check. So Joe the barber endorses the back of the check. This is important because it comes from a proverb. The endorsement on the back of the check is a proverb. And when students come in, I ask them, I say, why do you endorse the back of the check? And they all look at me and they say, well, to identify myself. Well, let's suppose that you took this check into the bank and the banker already knew you. And you said, you know me. I'm George Gordon. I'm not going to endorse the back of the check. Do you think the banker will take the check and process it without your endorsement? If you think so, listen, you've got a checking account at your bank, don't you? Test it. Walk into your bank where you're known. Maybe the bank president. Like if I walked into the Bank of Gainesville and I said, good morning, John, he would say, good morning, George. John Harlan, the banker, knows George Gordon. And yet I can assure you that John Harlan, the banker, would not take a check from George Gordon that George Gordon has not signed on the bottom line or endorsed on the back. I'll guarantee it. And if you want to test it, you try it. No banker will take your check without your endorsement. And here's the proverb. It says, a merchant's word is as good as gold. It comes from the merchants of the Hanseatic League of Hamburg, Germany in 1526. That's where it dates to. A merchant's word is as good as gold. Now here's another proverb. A free man's word is gold. Now, this entire banking controversy hangs on these two proverbs. One, predicated upon the Ten Commandments, a free man's word is gold. I'll tell you how good my word is. When you do business with me, I will pay you in gold coin. And boys and girls, you don't need to be concerned about whether or not my word is any good. I don't tell people, you know, you can believe me, you can trust me. I'm telling you the truth. My check is good. My check is in the mail. It may be. And a merchant's word is as good as gold. A merchant comes to you and says, here's my check. And you believe the merchant's got the money in the bank. You believe that merchant because his word is as good as gold. His word isn't gold because he's not giving you any gold. A free man pays in gold, period. So when you come here and you want to buy a cow, I expect you to pay me in gold. And when I go to you and I buy a car, I expect to pay you in gold. Although very few people actually want gold, and I've done that a time or two. I got to tell you about old Everett here. Everett had a piece of ground up here, 40 acres, and I wanted to buy it. And so I saw him out in the field one day making hay. And as he came around to the fence over there, I flagged him down. He stopped and shut off the tractor. And I said, Everett, I said, do you want to sell this 40? He said, well, I've thought about it. And then he said, if I was to sell it to you, George, what do you got in mind to pay me? And I said, well, about $40,000 in Federal Reserve notes. And he said, well, I turned Don down. He offered me 45, and I turned him down because I want 50. And I said, now, if you pay me 50, I think we can make a deal. Property wasn't worth 45. Property wasn't worth 50. And 40 was stretching it quite a bit. Now, Everett had paid 26 for it. In Federal Reserve note dollars, he paid 26. And he bought it from the Hurd estate, and old May Hurd and Joe Hurd bought that place in 1924 for $3,000 in gold coin. That's right. Joe and May Hurd bought that in 1924, 40 acres, $3,000 gold coin. Well, Joe died in 72, and May died in about 1990 or 91, and Everett bought it from the estate and paid 26 for it. Now, about, 2002, and I figured that it was worth probably $35,000. But I was willing to pay 40 and I offered 40, and already the inflationary expectation had driven the price up to $50,000. So I said, okay, I'll pay you the 50. Now, I said, I want to structure this transaction. I'm going to give you $6,400 in gold coin. He said, no, sir, I don't want gold. I want a cashier's check for $50,000. I said, a cashier's check for $50,000? He said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I said, well, I don't think that we can work out that kind of a transaction, at least not from my end of it, but I'll tell you how I think we can structure this. You give me your Social Security number, Everett, and you give me a bill of sale for $6,400 paid in U.S. gold coin. And I'll then take your Social Security number and the bag of gold into the gold broker, put it on the counter, and have him get a cashier's check made out to you with your Social Security number. I said, because I don't have a social security number and I can't get a cashier's check. You know, those of us that don't participate in these government programs and government franchises, you know, we're locked out of the banking system. And the day is coming when we will not be able to buy, sell, or trade in this banking system without the mark of the beast. You know, that's what our creator told us. He said, that's coming. So you need to start thinking about that. If you don't want the mark of the beast, you better be thinking about how you're going to pay your rent, how you're going to buy your gasoline without it. So Everett said, well, I don't care. It sounds good to me. And so we negotiated and transacted the deal, and he got the $50,000 cashier's check made out to him in his name from the bank, paid for by the gold broker, who then gave me the deed to the property. Now I got the deed, and I got the bill of sale, and it's for $6,400. I'm just waiting for them to raise my taxes. And I go and say, well, excuse me, but, you know, I paid less for that than it sold for the last time. Price went down, didn't go up. They raised the taxes here. This county doesn't raise taxes very often, but one of these days they will, and I'm going to call them on it, and they do. Now, the reason I bring this little story to your attention over here is to illustrate the point that most people don't want gold. Now, I'm not here to tell you that you ought to deal in gold, but your God told you to. I mean, your creator told you to deal in just weights and balances. Our founding fathers created in our Constitution, Article 1, Section 10. You Australians, you Canadians, you Englishmen over there have all used gold coin in the past. And some of you still have it to this day, being minted by your own government. No, you don't use it, but it's there. It's available. And when you come up in the judgment and you say, oh, I didn't know why I had to use Federal Reserve notes and checks and credit cards and Federal Reserve notes. And, you know, your God's going to look you right in the eyeball and say, Charlie, wake up and smell the coffee here. You Australians have got gold coin down there. You Canadians have gold coin. You Americans, you have gold coin. Why didn't you use it like I told you to? And you're going to say, well, you know, we kind of figured that you were dumb and old and didn't know much about economics. And so we decided to cut a fat hog in the back, and we decided to practice the second and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto through the eighth plank and get a social security number and blah, 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 you know. Now, I mentioned this before. I'm going to mention it once more. Every time you use your credit card and every time you write a check, you ratify this usury, checking, banking, fraud, this theft system imposed upon us from the top down. Now, it robs you every time you do that. But leaving that aside, you know, you're putting your stamp of approval on it and giving your creator the finger. I just thought I'd pass that on to you. Now, you know, your creator now is a nice guy. You know, this is sweet Jesus, you know, because he's a nice guy. But it was sweet Jesus, the nice guy, that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And it was sweet Jesus, the nice guy, that destroyed the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. And it was Jesus, the nice guy, you know, nice guy, that wrote the New Testament and told you, here's what I'm going to do to you people in Revelation chapter 6, you know, these four horsemen of the apocalypse. That's sweet Jesus over there, so I just thought I'd point that out. Sweet Jesus is kind of like my daddy. He was a hell of a nice guy when you shut up, folded your hands, and did what you were told. But when you gave him the finger, he comes unhinged and goes postal. Postal. For you people around the world, that means he goes off and then he bounces off the walls and flies off the ceiling and he hurts a lot of people in the process. And my God, there's going to be a lot of people going to get hurt here pretty shortly. Now, as a reporter, I'm just here to tell you that this is the way this game is played. I'm not here to tell you what to do or how to do it. But oftentimes you people say, well, I didn't know. Okay, so sit back and relax. Let me tell you. And this is how this game is played. So the other day I told you about House Joint Resolution 192, remember? Now I want to tell you about Joe the Barber over here, because Joe the Barber, when he takes this check over here, he wants to get goods and services for it. So he can endorse the check and cash it at the bank, and he can get money. Or he can endorse the check and pass it on to the next holder in due course. This is called a two-party check. So in this case, in our example here, Joe the Barber endorses the back of the check and gives it to Bill the Supplier. Bill the Supplier gives Joe the Barber a case of Wild Root Cream Oil worth $9. Now, Bill the Supplier has the check. He can endorse the back of the check, cash it at the bank. Or he can endorse the check and he can pass it on to Charlie the Grocer, which he elects to do, to buy a case of ketchup, which is worth $9. Charlie the Grocer has an ugly wife. He can cash the check and give his ugly wife $9 and send her to Sally the Beautician, or he can endorse the back of the check, give the check to his wife, who gives it to Sally the Beautician, who makes Charlie's wife beautiful again. This is the way a Federal Reserve note works. A Federal Reserve note is a note that comes under the law of bills and notes. It's an obligation, a liability of the Federal Reserve Bank. We call it money. It isn't, but that's what we call it. We even call it cash. It isn't. Cash is gold or silver coin. Go look it up in the dictionary. Cash, C-A-S-H. It's not a $20 Federal Reserve note. It's a gold coin. And it isn't that because I said so. It's that in spite of what I tell you. Which just ratifies the ignorance that goes on here, because we think $20 bills are cash, and we call them cash. They're not cash. But a Federal Reserve note passes like a check. You can pass a check just like a Federal Reserve note. All it requires is confidence. And then a merchant's word is as good as gold. And every merchant, when he signs his name, says, my word is as good as gold. I'll sign my name. I'm not here trying to act as a confidence man. You people, when you do business with me, do not have to have any confidence in me whatsoever. I don't require any confidence. I just pay in cash, gold coin. It's the merchant that you got to have confidence in. It's the banker you got to have confidence in. And so every time you sign your check on the back and you pass that check in, you're acting as a merchant in equity, acting in discharge rather than payment. When I pay in gold coin, I'm paying my debts at law. When you pass a check or a credit card, you're discharging your obligation. And as I showed you the other day, there's a clear distinction between a debt discharged and a debt paid. And when this note, this check, passes through the community 30 times and it comes to me, George Gordon, I look at the back of it and I accept this check and there's no place for me to sign it. And I hand it in to the bank teller and the bank teller says, I'm sorry, Mr. Gordon, but Sam the banker closed his account. This check is no good. What's my recourse? What do I do with a no good check? What do I do with a check that bounces? What do I do with a check that the account is closed on and I gave you my books for this $9 check? Everybody else got paid. Everybody else got wild root cream oil and beautician services and cases of tomato ketchup. But I end up with the old maid. What am I to do next? And with that, we'll talk about that next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Meanwhile, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. And that can all be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.